This is Barbara Glickstein, and you're tuned into Health Cetera, brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy. I'm here at TED Talks, and I was deeply moved by many talks, but this one in particular. Dr. Kef Fiedrasa is the assistant professor at Duke University. Everyone was asked the question, what if? His what if was, what if mental disorders were caused by electrical changes in the brain? Welcome to Health Cetera, Dr. Drasa.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You told an incredible story, which I'd love for you to share which part of it you'd like to with the listeners of Health Cetera, how you moved into medicine and your interest in mental health and the big questions that you're asking that need to be asked. Because we're not finding the right answers just yet, are we?
Yeah, I don't think we are. So I've had a lot of personal family experiences with mental illness, from committing family members to family members going missing and finding them hallucinating in different countries. And so for me, the pace of science and medicine has always been too slow, right? I think the approaches we've taken over the last 100 years, whether they're trying to figure out how to get really good mental health classification systems or making medications that target specific receptors in the brain. But the progress just hasn't moved fast enough for me. And so my premise has always been that if we try something different, it might not work. But we might as well take the risk of trying something different, because then in my lifetime, I'll be able to help my family members and my future family members that have yet to be born. So that's always been the premise and the approach that I've taken.
You were even frustrated in medical school, weren't you?
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. A lot of my experiences in how psychiatry is diagnosed and treated, I had so many experiences with, mothers who sent their sons and daughters off to college and were all of a sudden having experiences with whether it was bipolar disorder or schizophrenia, and the trajectory of their life changed in that very moment. And it was so incredibly hard to sit there and with people looking for help and knowing that I didn't have anything clear to offer them.
You told many powerful stories about that, in addition to your own personal sharing of family members. A young man, you told the story of a young man whose parents saw a rapid decline in his ability to stay in college.
Yeah.
These are stories in that age group. As a nurse, I know that it is when we begin to see those disorders of bipolar and schizophrenia.
Yeah.
This is an age gap.
Yeah,
those disorders begin to be seen.
That's correct. And so there might be small signs of these much earlier in adolescence, but where that large rapid decline happens, right? This is where folks are likely to end up in the hospital, where their families know that there's something absolutely wrong, where there's an abrupt change, will tend to happen in between late teens and late 20s, so somewhere in that age range. And so it wasn't uncommon. I told the story of CJ, one young man who had graduated valedictorian of his high school class and went off to college. And, he got in college and started having a lot of problems concentrating. And, parents took him out of school and very soon found him hallucinating. He was seeing angels and demons and had two suicide attempts before he ended up on my inpatient psychiatric unit. And unfortunately, CJ's story was a common one. So he wasn't the only one, only patient that I experienced at that age range. It wasn't the only time I delivered a diagnosis of schizophrenia to a parent, or bipolar disorder, or depression. He wasn't the only college student that I encountered after a suicide attempt. And the stories are much more common. And what I appreciated in those experiences was that what's so unique about psychiatric illnesses is that they are the illnesses that can profoundly affect your ability to advocate for yourself. And as a result of that, the advocacy and the helping someone navigate the mental health and the medical system falls to family members, whether it's parents or siblings. And so in a unique way, mental illnesses, there are illnesses that affect entire families, right? And so that was the part that for me was clear through my family experiences, but also being there on the side of provider, it was clear that these were illnesses that profoundly attacked and affected each member of the family member whose loved one was in the hospital.
It's also an age group, and I can tell you that in my own personal experience as well with friends and children that I've known since birth, where the self-medicating with either illicit drugs or sharing of drugs with friends who have prescription drugs, because the beginning of what are anxiety disorders,
sure.
starting with anxiety disorders or moving into perhaps other disorders that you have mentioned in terms of needing to be hospitalized.
Mm-hmm.
This is another sort of thing that parents are very concerned about, and also looking at signs that that may be what's also going on.
Sure.
And I have to say, often inadequately treated, and it's a population, young adults are a population that don't always find the right kind of clinician to help them through this course of being diagnosed.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a void even in large academic medical centers and cities where I live.
Yeah.
So let's talk about your idea. The idea that, and explain if you will, because you so beautifully described why electricity, what if mental disorders were caused by electrical charges in the brain? And we changed our focus from what is currently all about the chemical disorders of the brain. Could it be both? But let's start first with this description of the simple physiology for our listeners and why the distinction might be critically important to your research and ideas.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And so one of the things we can appreciate is that if we were, let's say, to just put electrodes on your scalp, these are the same types of electrodes that one uses to monitor seizure activity, we see electrical activity and electrical rhythms in your brain the same way we know that there are electrical rhythms in your heart. So it's pretty clear that the body uses electricity, electricity being defined as a movement of charges. In the brain, charges are directly linked to chemistry or ions. And so these chemicals can be sodium, potassium, calcium, chlorine, and their cells in their brain, you have about 200 billion cells, it's about the estimate. Just under half of them can move these chemicals back and forth across their surface. So they can move charge across their surface to generate electrical pulses. Now, so it's clear that when electrical information is moving back and forth between cells, it has everything to do with chemicals moving back and forth. And psychiatrists have classically focused on these chemicals. And so it's why terms like chemical imbalances are so pervasive. But it from a neuroscience standpoint, it turns out that that electrical information can also be really useful. And so you have all of these cells interacting with each other. And the premise is something has to allow them to work together, right? If they don't work together, the analogy I would describe it to is going to, you know, your favorite symphony orchestra, and then each instrument or each musician doing its totally own thing, right? What may sound like noise, one could equally think of it as an absence of music. And so I can define music as one thing, but there's no doubt that depending on the music that's playing, each person can have a different experience. So when you think of the goal of the brain being to generate music, then it might be the case that the medicines we use might make one musician play better or worse, or might target another musician. And eventually, if you have enough musicians not coordinated with each other, the music goes away. So it's the difference between playing a CD or listening to FM radio or listening to AM radio. The quality of the music can be diminished to a point where you can no longer appreciate the music. So the premise is that the brain coordinates all of these cells in the same way, like a conductor, right, of the orchestra. The brain has to know how to coordinate all these cells together to generate the beautiful music that allows us to move or to speak or to feel. And so in psychiatric illness, the hypothesis that we're working on is that what is lost is the conductor, the brain's ability to coordinate all of the musicians, all of the instruments, all of the cells. And so we describe these as little metronomes or electrical metronomes in the brain that coordinate the cells. And so the work that we're doing is to understand how these metronomes are organized in a normal, healthy brain. How many metronomes are they? Where are they? And then to figure out in the case of mental illness in the models we use in the lab, how those metronomes become dysfunctional. And if we can pinpoint these mental illness as an electrical disease, in the same way at times we can pinpoint the heart as an electrical disease, then we know that sometimes, yes, the beta blocker is right for the heart disease, but other times the pacemaker is right. And so the idea is to parse out the brain in the same way, where we say sometimes, yes, the antidepressant might be right, but other times a brain pacemaker electricity might be the best treatment.
You're a medical doctor, a psychiatrist, a neuroscientist, and I believe you also have an engineering degree.
Yes, I do.
And you have, you're a person that breaks down silos to find solutions. Mm-hmm. I see that. Are you also a musician?
No, I'm not. No, I wish I was.
You speak like a musician.
Yes, I am
you,
not.
you are conducting many, many things. How are you finding these metronomes that you're referring to in the brain? How does one locate them? Mm-hmm. What do they look like?
Yeah, so for us, the coordinating metronome that we've appreciated is the brain waves that you can record at the scalp. So it turns out that as those waves crash up and down and up and down, the firing or the electrical pulses of all these cells are timed to the waves going up and down. So these waves can actually coordinate lots of these cells firing or having electrical pulses together. And so the way we accomplish this in the lab, our model species that we use tends to be rodents, so mice and rats. We can cause genetic manipulations in those mice or rats such that they have behavioral profiles that look like bipolar disorder or schizophrenia. We can expose them to drugs of abuse like cocaine, or we can give them an amount of alcohol that then produces a phenotype that looks like addiction, or we can expose them to large amounts of stress so that they have symptoms that look like post-traumatic stress disorder. And so we're able to use these models and implant wires, each the size of a piece of hair, directly into their brain so that we can sample electricity all throughout the depth of the brain from many sites at the same time.
And you're imaging that with MRIs or CAT scans? What technology are you using?
Yeah, so we're using a technology called in vivo, which means inside, electrical recordings. And so we're able to sample that electricity from multiple sites of the brain. And then it becomes a real engineering problem.
Lucky for you that you're an engineer.
Exactly. So we use tools and approaches like machine learning. And the idea is, how do you take a lot of information and make sense out of it? We got connected with somebody whose background was geothermal imaging. And when I first got connected with him, I thought there was no way that we could ever use similar approaches to study the brain. But his argument was that you have one planet, and you're studying large, complex information, one planet, like weather changes and how weather changes influences crops growing. And if you can figure out how all that information comes together with one observed thing, which is a planet, you can approach the brain the same way. So can we ask about an individual brain, assume that each brain is individual, can we take an individual brain, look at that brain in multiple contexts, this is with a lot of information, and figure out how those electrical signals work together to create a state. And those states can be states of happiness, sadness, states of aggression, and then we can start to frame the brain in a way that we can figure out what the right ways to treat it, to stimulate it, and to ultimately scale it back into people to create new treatments.
So Dr. Drassa, have you, in your conversations with the patients who you care for, had them be able to describe to you what, although when one is in having this disorder, there are ways I know that people have painted what it felt like. There have been ways that people have produced, composed music. Mm-hmm. And is there a language that you've heard from the intimate conversations that you're able to have with your patients that describes any of this as a wave-like feeling or an electrical stimulating feeling or no stimulating feelings?
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating, right? So there are things we hear as psychiatrists that are in some ways common throughout our experiences, right? And so it's not unusual if you ask lots of psychiatrists throughout the country have taken care of patients with schizophrenia, for them to report that the patients say something like, the government is stealing my brainwaves, right? And
heard that myself.
And it's not unusual. You know, I've had patients who've had, you know, tinfoil caps on, right? And these are things that we psychiatrists will typically put in the chart to as a validation of their psychotic phenotypes. And I'm not saying that they're not, right? But it's a common sort of narrative that's shown up in multiple places in the patient's stories. For me, I think it's always important to sit and listen to each patient as an individual. And then as a scientist, I'm always open to the idea that things are true before we realize that they are.
You are, right? A true scientist.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there are ways that people are describing what their experience is.
Yeah.
Not only in psychiatry, but we in our healthcare system and as providers often don't, I often say to people who talk to me about their health problem that you are the scientist, your body is your laboratory.
Right.
You know best
mm-hmm.
what you're experiencing. And so I'm not surprised with the brilliance that you're bringing to your work, that you have the sensitivity of humanity
mm-hmm.
That you bring to as the listener and also as the person who is really trying to understand the story of that person.
Yeah.
We're quick to, and I know as someone who's chosen this field, you are not, but many of us are quick to make very quick judgments and have the issues of stigma in mental illness we're talking more about
mm-hmm.
in the culture.
Yeah.
But we're nowhere near where we need to be about the stigma of mental illness, whether it's related to the disorders that you are working with
mm-hmm.
or substance use and brain disease as problems.
Yeah. And I don't think we're where we need to be in terms of medicine either, right? I mean, there's no doubt that medicine reflects the culture, right? And some of the stigma you can appreciate in society, you can also appreciate right when you walk in the door in the hospital, right? And if you look across many of our hospital systems, psychiatry is often put in a different place in the hospital, right? It's a separate part, it's a separate
often
facility.
Often the walls are a different color.
The walls are a different color, right? I mean, it's not the nicest, most beautiful bed with the wood paneled walls. And I've appreciated this at a number of given places. And I often wonder how it is that we'll be able to convey that these illnesses have just a profound effect on people's lives. And, you know, this, and I don't want to get too far off track, but even the way we fund and pay for psychiatric care in this country is separate from the rest of medicine. And so I think a lot of that is then reflected in the immediate care that people get and how they're able to navigate system when they're directly engaged with the medical system as well as when they're home in their communities.
In addition to these stigmas, we know that access to mental health services in this country continues to be an issue,
mm-hmm.
and particularly for communities in low resource areas.
Mm-hmm.
We have lots of there is lots of health disparity issues,
mm-hmm.
including racism that many people in our country continue to face as they pass through that door to
mm-hmm.
seek out that care. And when research is looking like you are, but researchers and compassionate humanistic psychiatrists and neuroscientists
mm-hmm.
are beginning to provide data, like some of the other data that we've heard here today and over the last couple of days at TEDMed, that is evidence-based and will hopefully influence policies that will then impact access and impact treatment.
Yeah.
I try and find hope.
Mm-hmm.
I know that we're entering into a new administration with some major concerns on my part of where we're going to go with this. And in terms of the field of neuroscience, which is opening up doors in your field, the ability to be funded to do this type of work.
Mm-hmm.
These are all concerns that each one of us as citizens have to be concerned with. Do you have any particular concerns going forward around these issues in our political environment?
Yeah, well, I think my biggest concern is, I think sometimes scientists don't take on the responsibility they need to communicate about why what we're doing is so important, both to our country and people's individual health. And I think there's an important role that scientists play in the lab and advancing science, But just like a brain operates inside of a body and it reaches a balance with it, scientists, we operate inside a greater environment, right? And I think it's our role to continue to make that environment accessible to those that are in science and those that are not in science, to figure out how to advocate, to communicate with those making policy about the role in science and ultimately translating into things like mental health and Alzheimer's and autism, right? Things that are obviously major priorities for where our country is. So I think a lot of education needs to be done on, even in young scientists, how do you engage the community around you? One of the best examples for me is an amazing postdoctoral researcher that I have in my lab, who's also on the board of our local NAMI chapter. And so for
NAMI, for all listeners,
National Alliance of Mental Health. Yeah, and so she is both engaged in the community, is both interacting with families, is bringing neuroscience and making neuroscience relevant, but is also bringing that perspective into the lab and is providing a conduit between science and the improvement of the healthcare arenas that we care most about. And simultaneously then, NAMI can then go advocate for increased scientific funding because it's relevant to them what's happening. So I think we've got to break down a lot of the silos, right? The silos just aren't in disciplines of science. It's between science and outside of science, because I think a lot of us have shared objectives. So yeah, those are my concerns. I think everything else takes care of itself. If you have a country screaming for improved mental health care, right, it doesn't matter who gets elected or who's in charge, those things become a priority.
You did mention earlier in our interview that these disorders, these psychiatric disorders, impact the entire family, and that family mm-hmm. circle extends beyond the immediate family and into the community. Mm-hmm. And the possibility of looking at this from the very fresh eyes and brain that you have mm-hmm. Really does provide a sense of hope, something that I am so happy to mm-hmm. be able to share with the listeners of Health Cetera, mm-hmm. because many of us interface with family members, friends, colleagues, neighbors who are struggling with this issue. Mm-hmm. There isn't a lot of hope moments right mm-hmm. now.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Where does hope, what does hope mean for you around looking at these questions mm-hmm. from this perspective?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been a hopeful person, and I'm driven by hope. And, call me what you will, right? I believe that I will have looked back, played some vital role in ultimately providing a new type of treatment to my patients and their families and my family. And so I start with that end picture in mind and then work my way backwards to now.
Dr. Kaffee Drassa is the assistant professor at Duke University. I met him at TEDMED. His question was, what if mental disorders were caused by electrical changes in the brain? He's looking at that in very big ways as a psychiatrist, a neuroscientist, and an engineer. Thank you for joining me on Health Cetera today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.